Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. On November 25th, 1120, England suffered one of its greatest disasters with the sinking of the White Ship. Its repercussions would change English and European history. Author and historian Charles Spencer joins us to talk about his book, The White Ship: Conquest, Anarchy, and the Wrecking of Henry I's Dream. Welcome.
Thank you, Mindy. Delighted to be here.
You wrote this book to commemorate the 900th anniversary of the shipwreck, which you call Titanic meets Games of Thrones. This is really a bit of history that many people had forgotten.
Yes, I mean, even in the United Kingdom, it's really dropped off the chart because, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I'm in my late 50s now, when I was a kid, English history was a compulsory subject and lots of people were taught it, but it's dropped off now. It's all about Henry VIII and Hitler. And so dredging back 900 years to find this story was really a labor of love. But I realized it's something that it just shouldn't be forgotten. It was, as you said in your introduction, it was one of the great disasters that this country's ever suffered. And I wanted to commemorate it because it's so poignant and it's so meaningful and it's so devastating. You know, like any great shipwreck, there's an enormous loss of life. But in this case, it's about who actually died.
Yeah. 1120, King Henry I is sailing to England after winning a dramatic battle with the French. The White Ship was to follow, carrying his son, heir to the throne. The ship goes down off the coast of Normandy, killing his son and his dream. So before we get to that dramatic moment, tell us a little bit more about Henry I. He wasn't really meant to be king.
That's right. Now, Henry I is one of the great semi-forgotten kings of England. He was the youngest son of William the Conqueror and his three elder brothers. Well, one died in a hunting accident and he stole the throne when he hit the floor, basically left him to stiffen on a forest floor in death. And he raced off to Westminster Abbey and was crowned. And then he took on his eldest brother in battle and became Duke of Normandy. So he was this totally overlooked fourth junior brother who had an enormous amount about him and knew how to seize an opportunity. And, you know, he's still commemorated in England, not by name, but by deed. For instance, the finances, the government finances in England are called the Exchequer. And that's based on a checkerboard system where he accounted for the royal finances back just over 900 years ago. So he's left his mark in many different areas.
Yeah. Talk about the conflict with his brother.
Yes, well, he had conflict with two brothers. So when his father was on his deathbed, William the Conqueror, William let Henry know that he was going to leave the dukedom of Normandy, you know, that the pride and joy of the family, to the eldest son, Robert Curthose. And Robert Curthose is one of these footnotes to history, who's an extraordinary individual in his own right. Curthose is an odd word, but it's rather a cruel nickname coined by William the Conqueror for his son. It basically meant short legs because, you know, he was somebody of limited height. And William the Conqueror had a decades-long fight with his eldest son. But even so, on his deathbed, he was persuaded by the barons and bishops of Normandy that it would just be tidier to leave Normandy to Robert Curthose. But William the Conqueror had won England through his own merit and his own brilliance as a warrior. And he insisted he could leave that to who he wanted. And he left it to his second son, William Rufus. And then the third son had died by this stage. And Henry, dutiful son, by William the Conqueror's deathbed, said, well, what do I get? And William said, well, I'm just going to give you a lot of silver. And Henry I, this young boy, young man, actually, by this stage, who had hoped for so much more, complained. And William the Conqueror said, you know what? One day you'll be greater than both your brothers. And that was a prophecy that came true. But after William the Conqueror's death, the two elder brothers, Robert and William, conspired to take everything off Henry that he had been left. They used him as a pawn in their own battles between each other. They even imprisoned him at one point and besieged him and semi-starved him. They treated him appallingly. And this goes back to the point that nobody really looked to Henry I to be anything. He was just this junior brother who I think was everyone thought was just going to be consigned to a life of aristocratic obscurity. But he proved to be much more than that.
He was quite clever. You write, Henry was aware the most immediate threat to his rule came from unreliable elements in the upper nobility. Most of his leading aristocrats also had held ancestral nobility. Even if they swore loyalty to him for their English possession, they remained vassals of his brother in Normandy. Their loyalties were consequently divided in two. So tell us more about what was happening there and this character, Robert de Bellamy. Is that how you say his name?
Yes, he's a horrifying figure. Well, basically, the venture of William the Conqueror in 1066 to try and win England was incredibly risky. And he had to persuade the great nobleman of Normandy and the churchmen of Normandy to essentially subscribe to it and give him money and troops and ships. And their reward when he was so triumphant at the Battle of Hastings in 1066 was to get huge swathes of England for themselves. So these Norman barons suddenly had a foot on either side of the English Channel with enormous power in both camps, actually. And they also, as you mentioned in that quoted piece, that they were loyal to the King of England for their English land, but they were loyal to the Duke of Normandy for their Norman lands. And this meant that Henry I found he couldn't trust them. And the particular problem for him was this family, the de Bellemes, who were enormously powerful, both in Normandy and other parts of France and across England, all the way across England, really. And the worst of these was Robert de Bellemes, a truly bizarre figure. I, you know, if he was on the analyst chair today, I think he would be diagnosed as psychotic. But he was a very powerful psychotic, and he decided to really not respect Henry I's coronation as King of England at all, and set about doing what he wanted as a very powerful nobleman. And Henry I bided his time and then eventually issued these arrest warrants and said, you've broken all these laws and you're coming in. And Henry I was a good general. He had a lot of support. He had a very successful financial regime. He was able to afford to beat de Bellemes. But to give you an idea of what an extraordinary figure de Bellemes was, you know, this is a very religious age, and it's a particularly Old Testament type of religion that these people believed in. It's a God that smote you down and looked for vengeance and punished you. It wasn't a New Testament God. And de Bellemes was one of the very few people I can come across in this period of history who simply wasn't Christian. He didn't believe. And this set him free from a lot of the guiding principles of the time. You know, most people felt that if they behaved appallingly, they would go to hell. De Bellemes didn't believe in hell. He believed in constructing a hell, essentially, for his people. And at one point, the local churchman near to his greatest castle came to tell him off for not observing Lent. And he said, well, what do you want me to do? And they said, well, you know, a lot of people fast during Lent. So as a sort of punishment to these churchmen for being, in his eyes, impertinent to him, he had the 300 prisoners in his dungeons starved to death as a sort of perverse take on Lent. And another time, even more upsetting, he had a temper tantrum against one of his friends. And he had one of his friend's sons staying with him. This little boy was his godson. And he was so angry with this friend of his that he tore the eyes out of his godson as a sort of punishment. So this is a man completely out of control. But essentially, Henry I saw him off first in England and then closed him down in Normandy and sent him to prison for life. But de Bellemes became such a figure of fear and hate that, you know, sort of mythical figure of ghastliness that the Normans kept going for many hundreds of years afterwards as somebody to scare the children. You know, if you don't behave, Robert de Bellemes will come and punish you from the grave.
Yeah. The brutality of the time is striking. Punishments of the 12th century, they seem so barbaric to us, but common of the time, right?
Yeah. I think one of the important aspects of this period is the power of the Pope. Popes in the earlier medieval period had lost a lot of their power. And from the 1070s onwards, they decided that they were going to reimposed themselves on the royalty and aristocracy of Europe. And many people would say that bringing about the Crusades is one way of doing this. It was a sort of papal mission that he could control and call the shots on. And another one was that the Pope was adamant about the sanctity of life. So the Dukes of Normandy, who tended at this time to be quite religious, listened to this. And so when somebody noble or of any serious status came a cropper, you know, if they upset the king, they were not sent for execution, but they had incredibly unpleasant things done to them, castration and blindings being the main ones. And many people may think, I'd rather have been put to death, but this was considered merciful. In fact, Henry I, who we've discussed already, one of his courtiers decided to assassinate him and failed in the assassination. And the chroniclers at the time say how merciful Henry was, because rather than put this man to death, he only, and I stress that ironically, he only castrated and blinded him. So we're dealing with a very, very vicious time. And that's why, you know, when in your introduction, you said there is an element of Game of Thrones here. I mean, the stuff going on in real life matches the fiction of the TV series.
Yeah. So let's talk a bit about Henry I marries a princess of Scotland. So tell us about his relationship with his wife.
Well, quite unusually, when Henry I married, he married Princess Matilda of Scotland. She was somebody, they were in love with each other. And this is rather extraordinary. And the chroniclers at the time noted it. She was an unusual choice as bride because she had, we think, she had been in holy orders briefly. So she wasn't really allowed to marry the king. But the churchmen at the time bent over backwards because they wanted to please Henry I and let him marry who he wanted. It's rather a sort of different tale to what happened many centuries later with Henry VIII and the church being most confused by what he wanted to do with his love life. And Henry I married this girl. She was very religious, very learned. She did a lot of good work. She was a patron of the arts. She did all sorts of good things. She was considered a saint, not officially, but in terms of her outlook. And she sort of horrified and stunned her own family by setting up a hospital in London for lepers and treating them herself and even kissing their leprous wounds. So she was an incredible sort of force for good. But she and Henry had I think their marriage didn't last that long in a happy state. She produced a daughter and then the longed for male heir. So after that, they lived parallel lives. Henry I had an extraordinarily busy love life. I mean, in my book, I can trace 22 illegitimate children that he had. And very unusually for this time, he was happy to own up to them. Often the aristocrats and royalty at this time would behave with abandon and have all sorts of relationships and then deny that the children that resulted were theirs. But Henry I took a rather greater pride in his ability to sire all these children. And so his wife ends up as the Queen of England, living a very pious life, an intellectual life, a separate life. Meanwhile, Henry I, we think of these kings of England at this time being in England, but he spent half his time in Normandy each year defending his Norman dukedom from the King of France, who was always trying to undermine the Normans and the English. And when Normandy and England were under the same crown, effectively, this became the central ploy of the King of France, was to try and dismantle this incredibly difficult alliance against him.
We're talking with Charles Spencer. His new book is The White Ship, Conquest, Anarchy, and the Wrecking of Henry I's Dream. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with historian and author Charles Spencer. His book is The White Ship, Conquest, Anarchy, and the Wrecking of Henry I's Dream. So 1119, Henry won the battle against the French. Things were looking good. He'd beaten his enemy, bringing peace to his lands. He delivered a dynasty to his legitimate son. So take us to the night of November 25th, 1120, and the port of Barfleur. Tell us what happens.
Yes. So just to give it a little tiny bit of context, so Henry I becomes king in 1100. Over the next 20 years, he becomes as successful as he could possibly be. His one daughter's married the Emperor of Germany, and his son has finally been acknowledged as his heir, as the Duke of Normandy. The French have had to concede. So Henry I and his retinue go to Barfleur, a port in the north of Normandy, quite near Omaha Beach from D-Day. And this is the great launching point between Normandy and the south coast of England. And Henry arrives there, and a man comes forward and he says, "I'm the captain of the White Ship. And it was my father's great honor to be captain of your flagship, your father's flagship, in the campaign of 1066. And it would be my equal honor to take you back in your moment of great triumph to England." Henry I, rather a pragmatic soul and not really one for flattery. And he looks at this great ship and he says, "Look, it does look magnificent, the White Ship, but I've already made my arrangements and I'm gonna carry on as normal. But it would be great fun for my heir, William, and some of my illegitimate children and my great generals, some of my churchmen, the bureaucrats who control Normandy and England, to have the voyage that you're offering." And also he put his treasure chest on the White Ship. Henry I sets off into the night on the 25th of November, 1120. It's a still night with a steady breeze going north, and he heads for Southampton on the English south coast. William, the prince, who is his heir, is 17, and he does what 17-year-olds have done for centuries, and he has a bit of a party with his friends. And there are 300 very high-ranking people who are going to accompany him on the White Ship across the Channel. And they split open these casks of wine and they get massively drunk. And at this time, you know, the medieval mind was very fearful of the sea. They had very little understanding of it. If you look at the maps and the poetry of the time, it's clear that they thought all sorts of monsters lurked beneath, and if you fell in, you were done for. Very, very few people at this time could swim. And because of this, the monks, the nearby monks in Barfleur, had come to bless the White Ship before it set sail. But the drunken retinue on board chased them away before the ship could be blessed. And of course, in a very religious age, this was looked back on as a key moment. And then the drunken passengers decide it would be even more fun to get the crew drunk. And this is the key error of the night. The oarsmen, the captain, the helmsman, they're all drunk before they set off. And as they push out of the harbor of Barfleur, the cry goes up, "Why don't we try and overtake the king?" Now the king had set off several hours before and they weren't going to overtake him. But being absolutely inebriated, this seemed a wonderful idea. And the 50 rowers, who we know from the chronicles at the time were among the best around, bent their backs. The helmsman didn't realize how fast the ship was going and dropped the sail too soon. And so the White Ship ran into a rock at top speed. It's the Keyburf Rock. It's still there, actually, off Barfleur. And the ship cracked on one side, and then the crew tried to push the ship away with poles and oars, and this only made the rupture enlarge and the water pour in. And the prince gets away at this point, actually. Prince William is bundled into the one lifeboat on the White Ship and is being taken by his bodyguards to safety on the shore when he hears this cry above all the others, and he recognizes it as his half-sister, the Countess of Perche, who is calling for his help and insulting his manhood for deserting her when she's obviously going to drown. And this has an effect on William, and he orders the crew to turn round and go back for her. But the little lifeboat is swamped by people who are trying to get out of the sea. It's freezing and they don't know how to swim. And so the lifeboat, the prince, everyone goes down. There's literally at the end of this scenario, there's just two or three people left in the water or on pieces of driftwood, and the rest die very quickly.
Yeah. The water's very cold too. We're talking November, right? This is November 25th, so not likely to survive in that kind of water for very long.
No, you see, I'm a narrative historian, but I had to learn some science for this because it's, you know, I wanted to know how long did they have. Well, a lot of them drowned. A lot of them if they were clinging on something, died of hypothermia. And then there's another phenomenon, which I guess if you go swimming off Cape Cod in the wrong month, you get this thing called cold water shock. It's when you breathe in involuntarily, you go, and that is fatal. If you can't swim, you will take a lot of water in at that point, involuntarily into your lungs. And so a lot of them would have died from that. We know of three survivors at this point. The captain of the ship swam up to two men who had clambered onto a piece of mast. And he said, "Have you seen the prince?" And they managed to tell him that they had, and they'd seen him drown. And Henry I was not somebody you could give the bad news of his son dying and it being your responsibility to, and expecting to things to go very well at all. So at that point, the captain allowed himself to drown. And then you're left with two survivors, a butcher called Barreau from Rouen, which is the capital of Normandy. And he had pursued his noble debtors. They were leaving for London. He thought he may never see them again. He had pursued them on board to get his debt settled. And the reason that he survived, I believe, is not only did he get out of the water, but he was wearing the offcuts of his trade. He was wearing sheep and goat skin. And that, even when wet, you know, once you're actually out of the water, that will have a specific sort of latent heat that will keep you alive. And the other was a man with the surname of de L'Aigle, who was one of the great knights of Henry I's army. And they stay awake talking to each other through the night for as long as possible. It's clear from the butcher's account that de L'Aigle then gets hypothermia. He's just wearing silks and animal furs, not wool, but probably wool for equivalent. And he slips into the water and drowns. So that leaves the one eyewitness to this extraordinary moment of history as Barreau the butcher. And he's found the next morning drifting semi-conscious on this piece of mast by some fishermen from Barfleur. And they bring him in and they hear this extraordinary tale, this absolute disaster. The one man who could, the young man who could have been the next king of England, has drowned. And it's left not only personal tragedy, but dynastic turmoil in its traces.
And it takes a little bit before anyone will tell the king. So you've got these people celebrating, right? And they're getting the news and trying not to react because they're fearful of the king's reaction.
Yes. I mean, think of this time, you know, very few people living in England and those in the court, all interconnected and married, the nobility, etc., all very closely tied. And so the news arrives that the white ship has gone down and people realize they've lost close relatives, great friends, etc. But they are terrified of telling the king. Henry I is a very powerful king and a very moody man. And it falls to one of his nephews to tell him by duty, really, to tell him what's going on or what's happened. But he ducks this issue. He doesn't want to be the one to give the bad news. And he persuades a young page boy to tell the king. And the little boy goes in and he blurts out the bad news in a sort of just a torrent. And Henry I listens. And then the eyewitnesses say he then bellowed like a sort of wounded animal and fell to the floor screaming in shock and disbelief. And then is carried away. And he lies in bed for some time digesting this terrible, terrible news until his oldest advisor tells him, you know, we're talking about the early 12th century here, that he's not going to help anyone by crying. What's happened has happened. If he cries, he'll just give encouragement to his enemies and he must get on with it. And Henry I is completely broken by the loss of his son. He was actually very close to him and to the two other illegitimate children who died in the shipwreck. And he also openly grieves the great men of his army who've perished, men who he's been on campaign with for 20 years have died in this catastrophe. And also a lot of very important and influential women, some of whom he's related to. There's 18 senior aristocratic ladies who die in the shipwreck. And he's trying to digest all of this. And the first thing he does actually is very pragmatic. He is a widower by this stage, and he casts around for a new bride with which to have children. I mentioned earlier he had an extraordinary number, 22 illegitimate children, but none of them could become the next king or queen. The church had decreed that illegitimacy ruled you out of the succession by this stage. Quite a change, actually, because William the Conqueror was illegitimate, but he was allowed to become Duke of Normandy. But in the intervening 50 years, the church had got a grip on various parts of society, and this was part of it. And the point being, you know, that the king had to produce a new heir or leave catastrophe and anarchy in his wake. So he marries this young, beautiful, noble woman from what is now Belgium, and she is made to stay with him at all times in the hope that there'll be a new son, but nothing happens. The king, in the remaining 15 years of his life, has no child in wedlock, and this is why the white ship becomes quite so disastrous.
Mm-hmm. And we should say that the no child with the second wife, but she does go on later to have children without him, with her next husband.
Yes,
right?
It's interesting. She does. She has 6 children with her second husband after the king's died. I mean, it's just, you know, who knows? Was he depressed? Was he unwell? What had happened? You know, but he was unable to sire, as they call it at this time, to sire any more children in that marriage. And yes, and it's interesting because that brings us on to, well, he did have one other legitimate child, Matilda, but she was a daughter. And it's so interesting when we look at the sort of gender politics of the time. What's clear is that this daughter, Matilda, was incredibly able. She had been married to essentially the Emperor of Germany, and she had proved to be a very useful consort. He was away often on warfare or diplomatic missions, and he was happy to leave her to help run his dominions. And she did this with great ability and wisdom. But to the English and Norman aristocracy at the time, it was very difficult to think of a woman on the throne of England. And I spent a bit of time in the book looking at this. So essentially, there was no precedent for this in English history, except going way back into sort of Roman times, where there would be chieftains who were female of tribes. But essentially, Henry I was such a powerful presence and so terrifying to his people that when he insisted that they, the lords and the churchmen, acknowledge Matilda as his successor, they did so. But when the king died in late 1135, from eating too many lampreys, a sort of oily, eel-like creature from the water. When that happened, they all said, no, well, you know, it can't be. And that's the sort of second wind of the book, The White Ship, because mm-hmm. the one man who now comes to the fore is a nephew of Henry I, a man called Stephen of Blois, and he rushes across the channel to seize the crown, and he has the distinction of being the most important person to have got off the white ship. People say that he either took one look at how drunk the crew were and thought, I'm not having any of this, or the dominant theory is that he had an upset stomach and he didn't want the embarrassment of being on a 12-hour journey to England with that condition, and he took himself off the ship. So he is the immediate benefactor of the disaster.
Hmm. So let's talk a little bit about this battle for the throne then between Matilda and Stephen. Matilda doesn't exactly, you know, walk off into that. She's quite a formidable woman, right? And Stephen, although he does become king, he's not really the best king, is he?
No. Well, one of the backdrops of this tale, which I hadn't appreciated before, was how very, very keen people were in England to have a new king when the old one had died. There's an extraordinary lack of respect for the dead king. For instance, when William the Conqueror died, people were waiting for a long time for him to die. He had a rupture in his stomach from a part of a saddle hitting him too hard there. When he died, all the great men rushed to go and secure the safety of their estates. And the servants just stole everything from William's room, even taking the jewelry off his body. Equally, when his successor, William Rufus, was killed in a hunting accident, he's left on the floor, and a couple of peasants are told to sling him on the back of a horse and take him to the nearest city while the great men shoot off. And this shows you this extraordinary thing to us. If you think of the moment between monarchy, a monarch's reign now, or between presidencies, etc., there's a sort of orderly succession. This was not the case 900 years ago. People scrambled for power, and often people would say, we'll take that candidate, because they were ready to go. It's very, very odd for us to understand this, but there is a period at this time, the period between the death of one king and the coronation of the next king was lawless. I mean, you could literally murder your neighbor and you could never be held to account, because you had not broken any particular king's peace. You had to have a king on the throne. And Stephen was a beneficiary of this. He was not expected to be the heir at all. Nobody had thought of it, I don't think, apart from him. But by the fact that he raced across the channel and was ready to be crowned, he was a good soldier. He was a very nice man. People liked him. They said people of all backgrounds liked him. He had a sort of common touch. But that didn't make him a good king. From our point of view, all of the qualities of a good ruler now were not very interesting to the medieval, your average subject in medieval England. They wanted, above all else, peace. And if that came with a really, really tough king like Henry I, they're prepared to accept it. People celebrated the fact that Henry I strung up common criminals in large numbers. And they said, you know, with rose-tinted spectacles, they'd look back at his reign and say it was a time when a young girl with a pocket full of gold could go from one end of his kingdom to the other unmolested. And that's a sort of lovely concept. But what it showed is this respect for really strong law. Stephen was not that man. He was much gentler. And when enemies dared to fight against him and he beat them, he would take their word that they wouldn't do it again, rather than subject them to terrible mutilation, which was expected at the time.
So tell us a little bit more about Matilda at this time. You know, what type of woman, what her quest to be recognized?
Yes, well, it is interesting, and I didn't appreciate this until well into writing the book, but she was seriously a serious candidate for being a great monarch in her own right. She was efficient, she was intelligent, she was ruthless, thoughtful, and this was all really good news if you were a king. What's clear is the gender prejudice at this time meant many people think of her as unladylike. This is the great complaint at the time. After 3 years of Stephen being on the throne and becoming ever more obviously incompetent, people started to say, oh, you know what? I think we promised a long time ago that we wanted to see Matilda be queen. And so they started to support her, the King of Scotland, who was related to her, and a couple of very important men in England. But they assumed that she would just be a sort of cipher, a queen in name only, while the three of them would divide up the serious business of ruling the country. She was having none of that. She had a lot in her, I think, of William the Conqueror, her grandfather, and Henry I, her father. Whereas they'd been praised for their strength of purpose and their ruthlessness, she was seen as a totally unacceptable version of a lady of the time. She got very close to being crowned in England, in London, having arrived with her own army, and there was a sort of massive civil war, one of the bloodiest civil wars in Europe and European history, where the monks wrote at the time, the chronicler monks wrote about England being drenched in blood. And when she had her fingertips on the crown, she was about to be crowned. The people of London sort of stormed in to her banquet and drove her away, and she fled. She's such an interesting figure in history, because every time the going got tough, she just stuck at it. There's a wonderful tale, really worthy of, you know, a movie rather than true life, where she and her army are holed up in the city of Oxford. It's actually at the castle there. And everything looks very grim. It's just before Christmas. There's snow on the ground. There's clear rebellion among her own garrison. They're about to turn on her. She is surrounded. The game is up. But not for her, you know. She slips into a white cloak with her two best knights, and they come down the castle wall in the night, and they go through the snow, through the enemy, in this camouflage, and get away. And it's extraordinary. Even our enemies were impressed. She was somebody who never, ever gave up.
We're talking with historian and author Charles Spencer about his book, The White Ship, Conquest, Anarchy, and the Wrecking of Henry I's Dream. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. With us today is Charles Spencer. His book is The White Ship, Conquest, Anarchy, and the Wrecking of Henry I's Dream. I would imagine it's difficult to research something that happened so long ago. So what were the challenges? I mean, you have some documentation, but how did you find out all of them? How did you research this book?
Yes, well, actually, you know, my three previous books were on the 17th century, and they were much harder in a way because there's just so much material, especially as it was our civil war in the middle of the 17th century. Going back 900 years presented its own challenges. There were really nine principal sources that I found, primary sources. They all have religious backgrounds because at this time, with literacy goes usually an ecclesiastical education. And for me, there was no difficulty. All of them covered the White Ship disaster because it was so clearly absolutely appalling and a shattering event in the life of the British monarchy. Even though they didn't know, as we do from this distance, that Henry I would have no more children. It must have seemed very likely that he would because he'd had so many before. But looking at these sources, what was interesting to me was how prejudiced they are from a Christian point of view. And I say that without criticism, but this is a period where people tended to see every tiny deed and act as coming through God's will. And so I don't believe that this Prince William died because he was vain or because he had upset God or whatever. I think he died because he and his friends and the crew were drunk and they had an accident. But the chroniclers of the time had to make the disaster fit into a divine plan. So you will find that they all say that the prince was a complete waste of time. But there's not many 17-year-olds who would want to be judged at that moment as being at the sort of the most promising part of their life. So you have to pick through what I call the prejudice and try and look at the fact. And often it's comparing one source with another. The best source I found was this man with this extraordinary name, Orderic Vitalis, who was an English boy sent by his very religious father to become a monk in Normandy. Against his will, of course, he never saw his family again. But his father believed that if he made this sacrifice, the boy would be guaranteed a place in heaven, and that was worth the pain of never seeing him again. Now, because of his English roots, and because he was in the right part of Normandy, he was absolutely fascinated by this tragedy. You know, it was his homeland that had had the tragedy, and it was on the shore near to him. And it's quite clear to me, I can't prove this, of course, it's quite clear to me that the account that he gives is the nearest. It seems to me to be an eyewitness account, and it must be that he met Barrow the butcher, because the details are so specific and so intricate and amazing, actually. But you have to help the reader here, not by feeding them your suppositions, by just telling them what you know and what the people said at the time, and let them draw their own conclusions. I think that's the only fair way to do it.
Yeah. You know, one person we haven't talked about that was really fascinating to me in the book was Roger of Salisbury.
Yes. So he is an extraordinary. So Henry I, if he's famous for anything, it's not just the exchequer that he formed, the great treasury of England, but his very, very clever reliance on meritocracy. So he realized that he couldn't rely on the great barons and the aristocratic families because they had their own interests, self-interests. So Henry looked for very able men who, as the chroniclers at the time said, he rose them from the dust. He looked for bright men who would be entirely loyal and entirely dependent on him for their power and status. And prime among these is Roger of Salisbury. Roger was a priest in Normandy who Henry I first enjoyed because as a young, very busy, energetic man, he was religious, but he wanted to get on with whether it was warfare or hunting. He wanted to have his religion served up in a bite-size edition so that he didn't have to spend hours in church. And he was very impressed that Roger could rattle through mass at quite a speed. And he became, during Henry's years as a rather impoverished aristocrat drifting around Europe, he became one of his henchmen. And he eventually was rewarded with what would be the equivalent of becoming prime minister of England. There was no prime minister at this time, but it's very much, it's called the judiciary, in charge of the judiciary and what we would call politics, and in charge of pretty much everything except the army. And this is a simple village priest rose to this because he was so clever, particularly with money, but also with diplomacy. And yeah, he became the second most important person in England after the king. Quite an astonishing accomplishment for an ordinary man, really.
Yeah. All right. So King Stephen, you talk about the Civil War. Talk about who succeeds King Stephen. He does die.
Yes.
And ironically, Henry II. <Yes. laughs>
Well, after all of this, so we have Henry I dies in 1135, and then King Stephen grabs the throne. And then there is a 19-year civil war of incredible barbarity. And it reaches a state quite, you know, after a dozen years, it reaches a state where nobody's going to win it. And the country is just destroying itself. Stephen controls London and the East, and Matilda's forces control the West. And it's just disastrous for everyone. So through the persuasive powers of the senior barons and the senior churchmen, a compromise has to be reached. And it's agreed that Stephen, he can stay on the throne till he dies, but his children are not allowed to inherit the throne. That is the end of it. Equally, Matilda, Henry I's only legitimate daughter, has married against her will as a second husband, a very young, very handsome count, who is from Anjou, the Anjou area of England, and his family are known as the Plantagenets. And they are really a family that people are terrified of because they have the most appalling temper, but they are very able. And it's agreed that when Stephen dies, the eldest of Matilda's sons, Henry Plantagenet, will become king. And in 1154, when Stephen dies, he becomes King Henry II. And this is the most astonishing legacy of the White Ship disaster. Essentially, it was the end of the Norman dynasty. The Normans and the Plantagenets had a multi-generational hatred of each other, but the Plantagenets scoop the pool. They get England and they get Normandy. They already have Anjou. They are involved. He soon marries Henry II, the most powerful and wealthiest woman in Europe, Eleanor of Aquitaine. So he essentially controls a third of France. And this puts England into a completely different spin. You know, without the White Ship, I think England, there's a very strong argument that it would have just remained a rather unimportant place off the North Sea and in the Channel. But by Henry II becoming king, it brought England into the mainstream of European politics. And we get the Plantagenets. We get the Plantagenets from 1154 on the throne until 1485 when the Tudors take over. So quite astonishing that a whole dynasty dies and a new one is formed, which controls England and a lot of the political dynamic of the next 300 years, all because the White Ship went down. And you think about that, there would not have been Richard the Lionheart. There wouldn't have been Magna Carta. There wouldn't be Henry VIII. There wouldn't be Elizabeth II. There would have been a completely different cast of characters over the last 900 years.
You write about history, often forgotten history. How do you choose your book topics?
Mindy, I don't have a set plan. I go from book to book on the strength of the story and how much it grabs me. So each of these books takes me 3 years to research and write. So I don't set off on any of them unless I'm absolutely riveted by the story. And my previous four books all fed one from the other. I found an interesting aspect in one of them to follow. This one came about completely by accident, because you know when you know something, you often assume other people know it. And I gave a talk to an American audience at Leeds Castle over here in England about 5 years ago. And I gave it about the Queens of England. And I mentioned the white ship, because I mentioned how Matilda didn't become queen when she should have. And, you know, I just saw people really snap to attention. They were really interested in this story. And then I looked it up, and there it was, 900 years anniversary was coming up very soon. And I set about writing it. And I without being remotely pompous, I mean, I love the idea of sharing great stories with an interested public. I'm a narrative historian. I tell stories that happen to be true. And I try and find stories that are as good as any fiction, even though they're nonfiction.
And so have you found a nugget in this story that you want to take on for another book?
I actually, I'm going completely different, and I'm doing something 20th century, but it is a really interesting story to me. You know, that's the other thing. What I find interesting, somebody else might not find interesting. So you have to have a very honest publisher. They can see if it works or not.
So you're going to give us a hint on what the topic is, or do we have to wait for the book?
I'm afraid I have to wait, not because I want to do a sort of drum roll of anticipation, but because I'm sadly not allowed to say what it is. I think they always worry, because I tend to do anniversaries of things. I think the publishers always think, well, don't tip off other people because they might do it too.
We will have a link with more information about the book, The White Ship, Conquest, Anarchy, and the Wrecking of Henry I's Dream at our website, capeandislands.org. Charles Spencer, thanks so much for taking time with us today. We really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Mindy, and thanks for such great questions. It's so rare that somebody's read the book as well as you have, so thank you.
Thank you. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.